This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under-the-radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Robb.
And I'm Zach Gorchow. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is making national headlines this week as Democrats continue to respond to President Joe Biden's disastrous debate performance last week.
We're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden.
Some of Biden's answers to even softball-type questions have left many concerned about his ability to beat former President Donald Trump in November. Now, a handful of names have been floated as people who could step up if Biden were to step down. And Whitmer seems to have gained an incredible amount of traction in a short amount of times with calls for her to be the nominee. So let's start here, Zach. Is Whitmer the great hope for Democrats?
Well, among some Democrats, she's the great hope, but, you know, they're seeing a popular governor of a Midwest swing state where there are several swing states. Governor Whitmer won twice by large margins. And, you know, with President Biden at his lowest ebb, I think, since his first campaign for president in 2020, she does strike people as a salve, maybe the answer. But most Democrats, and that includes Whitmer herself, would say Biden is the nominee and he will remain the nominee. Biden stepping down as the nominee less than 2 months before the convention, and it is his call, he cannot be ousted, would create massive chaos, many Democrats say.
And Whitmer has repeatedly said in the past that she would not run for president this term. She wouldn't do it in the primary. She keeps saying now that she has no plans for this. But the atmosphere still feels a little different, no?
Big time. I mean, I feel like I can't go anywhere without seeing an article that has Gretchen Whitmer in the top two or three of potential stand-ins. You know, his debate performance, the president's, has turned the whispers into roars among Democrats that his declining strength as a speaker and visual presence at the age of 81 could lead to the return of Donald Trump to the White House. But all indications right now are Biden plans to remain the nominee. Thus, Whitmer, who we should mention is co-chair of the Biden campaign, will continue to help him not launch her own bid. Further, there are other big name Democrats out there who would run should Biden bow out.
Yeah. Whitmer keeps saying the call is not coming from inside the House, but there was a story in Politico this week where an unnamed potential presidential rival of Whitmer's tried to convince the writer of the article that she, Whitmer, had told the Biden campaign Michigan was no longer winnable. That was not what Whitmer said. Apparently, she only indicated the debate would make Michigan more difficult. And the governor, who loves herself a good four-letter word, said on Twitter or X that anyone claiming she said Biden couldn't win Michigan is full of shh, married with it.
Well done, Shayna. You know, my takeaway from that article in Politico is that Washington folks, particularly those around Vice President Kamala Harris, remember her, the most obvious successor, should the unlikely happen, and Biden hang it up, are eyeing with a very wary eye Whitmer's growing national profile. She has a book coming out next week and a national book tour lined up. She's been barnstorming the country, showing up at flashy events far from our fair Water Winter Wonderland, and I'm wearing my special new Water Winter Wonderland shirt, thanks to the store that I got that from, like the Aspen Institute. She visited swing states for Biden, but also is stopping in non-competitive states like Texas to speak to Democrats. These are the kinds of things someone does when they have the presidency on the brain, perhaps in 2028.
This attempt to wound her in the Politico story felt a bit like what you told me is a welcome to the NFL moment in national Democratic politics, which is something that I wasn't very familiar of, but it seems as though that means it's an acknowledgement that she's in the big leagues and she needs to be here to play.
Yeah, absolutely. Big time. In the end, though, this is Biden's call. By virtue of his winning the Democratic primaries, the convention delegates are his. If Whitmer is eyeing the White House and she insists she does not know what she will do in 2028 when she will no longer be the governor, She's likely waiting 4 more years.
We're going to take a short break, but stick around, because when we come back, we're talking with Gong War reporter Ben Solis about the big cases the Michigan Supreme Court will be deciding this month, as well as the latest in redistricting and so much more. We'll be right back after this break.
Welcome back to Mishmash. I'm Zach Gorchow. Joining us now is Gong War reporter Ben Solis, our expert when it comes to all things Michigan Supreme Court, redistricting, and Cleveland sports. Ben, good to have you back on Mishmash.
Good to be here, Zach. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Well, legal eagles out there in Mishmash land know that the Michigan Supreme Court's term ends July 31. Ben, there are a handful of really big cases on the court's docket this month. What would you say is going to cause the biggest shakeup, no matter what's decided?
I think those who are watching the courts, like I am, are really focused on the adopt and amend ruling and fallout. This is a case that will decide if 2 initiative petitions from 2018 that were essentially adopted by the legislature instead of going to the ballot and then later gutted in the same term will either take effect, and also answer the underlying question if the legislature can constitutionally do what it did in 2018. So a lot of implications here.
I can't believe we're going back 6 years on that particular issue. What exactly is at stake here? Is it it's the idea that if the citizens bring a petition, theoretically to put it on the ballot, it actually, people sometimes don't know, goes to the legislature first. And if the legislature approves it, it never goes to the ballot. I mean, what would you say is at stake here?
Well, I mean, at stake is whether or not the legislature can do this at all. And, you know, if it is found that the legislature can do this, that what it did in 2018 was constitutional and within their rights, that, you know, has been posited could be an end to direct democracy in this state. If the legislature acts as a gatekeeper from now on and, you know, decides to take up a petition, an initiative that it doesn't like, doesn't want to go before the voters, and then can later completely change the content of that initiative, you know, people are very worried that that means that they don't have a direct line to make changes to laws as they do now.
What are some of the other big cases that the court has already decided so far this term?
Well, one of the big ones that I thought was interesting was an Elker case. This was a case that was actually pretty recent. They decided that some Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act retaliation claims can be filed by third parties. And what's interesting there is that the court took up a case where the Department of Corrections was sued by an individual who had a friend who was fired on discriminatory grounds. And the case was brought by this third party. So the question in that case was, is that even allowable under ELCRA? And the court found that it indeed was. And what's interesting there is that there are other cases potentially pending before the court that the Court of Appeals just ruled on, dealing with elected officials and their ability to sue governments that they elect, that they represent. And what I found interesting is that this court, this particular majority, has over the years expanded ELCRA quite a bit, not necessarily reading in new causes of action in which you can sue under, but really looking at the letter of the law and seeing avenues where it already exists to have these kinds of actions, like this third party one, which was kind of absurd to think that you could do that. The ruling said that you indeed can, because it exists in the letter of the law. In the case of this Court of Appeals ruling that might find its way before the court, you have yet another avenue for them to expand that pretty widely. So,
Ben, I want to ask you about some cases that are not among those that the court must decide before its term ends. But the court recently issued orders regarding the possibility of extending the ban on sentencing those 18 and under to automatic life without parole to 19 and 20 year olds. Tell us about what's going on there and what are some of the stakes with these orders?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this is a new one that, as you mentioned, has been ordered for oral arguments, but they have not heard them yet. But it could have some maximum implications here. There's been a lot of movement over the past decade, whether that's before the U.S. Supreme Court and eventually our court, you know, knocking down automatic sentences of this nature for 17-year-olds. Our Supreme Court in 2022 ruled that 18-year-olds or younger could not be sentenced to these types of automatic life without parole sentences. So this new case, and it's a batch of cases that have a few consolidated ones, but, you know, two really that stand out, may extend that even further past 18 years old. The cases that implicate this are Parks and Stovall, People v. Parks, People v. Stovall. These are the ones that were decided a couple of years ago by our Supreme Court. And in Parks, the main holding from Justice Elizabeth Welch was that sentences of this nature failed to account, you know, mitigating circumstances of youth, the development of the late adolescent brain, and emerging science that says that, you know, youth may or may not fully understand the ramification of those heavy crimes when they commit them and then eventually have to be sentenced to life without parole. Stovall is in the same vein, but that, you know, affects 17-year-olds, saying that, you know, any 17-year-old or younger who is sentenced to one of these, it's unconstitutional to sentence life without parole for second-degree murder. So the implication here is that the Democratic majority bench has already ruled, you know, with some pretty sweeping changes to this case law and to this precedent. And this same majority will be ruling on these cases. And in both of those previous cases, the Democratic majority held strong, and the three dissenting justices were those nominated by the Republican Party, including its chief, Justice Elizabeth Clement. So, you know, it's very possible that we could see the court continuing to expand this definition, expand this holding that says, yeah, maybe, you know, 19 and 20 year olds don't have the capacity to understand those ramifications. But what is interesting here is that both Justice Welch and Justice Richard Bernstein have been more of swing votes, wild cards, harder to predict over the last couple of terms. And based on arguments that I've heard, you know, similar to this from Justice Bernstein, it may be hard to predict whether or not they'll go for something like that. Will that line of 19, 20, pretty further into adulthood, be a line where Bernstein or Welch won't want to cross? That'll be interesting to watch for me.
So, Ben, let's switch gears from what you're going to be living life as a reporter doing in July as the court issues a bunch of decisions to what you lived life doing in June. The Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. I hope I'm not giving you the shakes just by mentioning
PTSD it. A little PTSD there.
So after so many hours of tracking this saga, and in this particular case, it was the rewrite of the Michigan Senate map in and around the city of Detroit, as ordered by a court. Is this business finally settled? What is the latest?
One would hope, and even just you mentioning that puts out the jinx in the universe that it potentially won't be. For this matter, for the court's remedy of the situation that they found themselves in, yes, this is the end, potentially, at least on the commission's end. As you know, the court, a three-judge federal panel, that heard this case, ordered the commission late last year to go back to the drawing board to redraw the House and the Senate map that they adopted in 2022. And the first process was the House redraw, which went fairly smoothly, you know, had more moving pieces because, you know, smaller districts, more of them. But it seemed to get through the commission pretty quickly. The Senate process was a little more arduous. It was a little harder to grapple with the geography because of the size of the districts, the changes that needed to be made. And there were, you know, several competing maps where commissioners felt very strongly that those maps did the best to remedy the court's order, as well as work well for the people of Detroit. And if you remember, the court found that those maps, the adopted maps previously, violated the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause because the commission relied too heavily on race when they drew those maps. So drawing race blind was one of the names of the game for both of those maps, as it was here in the Senate map. But really the consternation that emerged was just this infighting over which map really truly did the best for the people of Detroit. And so the map that they did land on has, you know, four VRA districts, opportunity to elect, pretty compact, but really consolidated districts, concentrated rather districts in the city of Detroit. Not a lot of crossing over that 8 mile line, which we saw in some of the previous maps. So, you know, it does give on a first look a better chance at Black representation for the city of Detroit. But it also opens up if, you know, God forbid, you know, potential other challenges that might arise if those districts are indeed too concentrated. We don't know quite yet because the court has them. It's in the court's hands, and we'll know by at least hopefully mid-July to late July whether the court accepts their maps. They did previously with the House map. So, you know, the same process was followed this time to a pretty solid T. So it's really just a kind of a wait and see. But I know that the commission is confident that they did the job, remedied the situation. And, you know, the plaintiffs who sued them seem to be happy with the map that they got to. So we'll just have to see.
Given how long and arduous and litigious this whole process has become, what would you say is the fallout from all of this mishigas?
Well, I mean, it's yet to be seen. We still have to have the maps approved by the courts. That'll be the biggest hurdle for them. But overall, I think that the process was followed at least enough to the T that they can expect the court to give them a fair shake. And unfortunately, we just won't know until, you know, later this month to see what the actual fallout is. But it seems that people are at least, liking of these maps. They have approved of them through the public comment process. The Crane map was the one that rose to the highest among the public commenters, and that's being chosen. So we'll just have to see.
So, Ben, it seems evident that the changes to the Michigan House map earlier this year will not affect which party has the better chance to win control of that chamber in November. The Michigan Senate, which is the map that was redrawn here, is not up for election this year, won't be up for election until 2026. But what about the partisan changes to that map?
Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of change there. There are a few things that are shaken up, but not to the degree that I think anybody has to be worried about. You aptly noted as we were looking through these maps that, you know, if the Democrats expected a better map than what they got in 2022, they did not get that. And if the Republicans were looking for a major in, they didn't really get that either. As you know, and as when we analyze the map, there are a lot of open seats, so there is, you know, some in play there. But for the most part, you know, you look at someone like Senator Michael Weber of Rochester Hills. He had configurations on other maps that absolutely blew up his district. This time, it looks like his district is pretty maintained. There may be a little bit of ground that he could lose some standing in that district, but overall, mostly the same district. And when you look to Senator Rosemary Bayer or Senator Veronica Kleinfeld, two Democrats, their districts were not changed so much, but, you know, they're not as great as they were for them in the 2022 map. There may be an opportunity for Republicans to kind of target which one they want to take on and potentially grab a seat there. But, you know, for the most part, it doesn't shake things up very much.
So, you know, it's really interesting when you look at that, you know, right now it's a 20-18 Democratic majority. And, you know, people were looking pretty closely at Veronica Kleinfeld's district, Democrat from East Point, her district's in Macomb County, a little bit of Detroit. I think Republicans were hoping she'd get pushed much farther north, get a much more, you know, Republican tilting district. That didn't happen. Her district actually got a little better for her. But the trade-off for the Democrats was Rosemary Bayer, who right now has a pretty solidly Democratic district. It's probably in that like 56-58% Democratic district range. She ends up getting pushed out into Western Oakland County and get some much more competitive districts. It's almost like Kleinfeld and Bayer have switched places. But the bottom line it's still basically the same competitive level of the map going into 2026.
Yeah, certainly. And then, you know, that was the commission's charge to, you know, give no favor to any incumbent, to any, you know, political party. It was a journey to try and, you know, create the fairest map for the state and for the voters. And, you know, that kind of happened again.
So, Ben, Detroit was really the focus of a lot of the problems that came out of this redistricting effort. What changes for Detroit under these new Senate maps? How are things going to be different for them?
As I mentioned, you know, the districts for Detroit are a lot more concentrated. That could pose some interesting legal ponderance and potential challenges. But, you know, that was one of the things that you know, Detroiters had said they wanted. They didn't want a lot of this, you know, crossing over 8 Mile and wrapping in the suburbs, as we saw in the previous maps. You know, it definitely gives them a better shot at representation from a Black Detroit representative, a candidate of their choice. And, you know, we do see that there are four U.S. Voting Rights Act compliant opportunity to elect districts that were forged out of these maps. So, you know, four solid districts, three that are in the city of Detroit, one that kind of extends a little northward, but still wraps in enough area where there is enough concentration of Black voters, where it does offer a pretty good shot at an opportunity to elect. So those are the big changes, and they Black Detroiters seem to be okay with that. There were a lot of different preferences on the maps from people of Detroit, but you know, I think that the plaintiffs who did sue them were overall pretty happy with this when it came out. The map that did get adopted was one of the ones that, you know, a former representative who led the charge for these plaintiffs really said that she liked through the process and, you know, immediately praised that decision on that map when it was adopted. So, you know, I think this does remedy not only the court's concerns, but also Detroit's concerns as well. But, you know, we'll see how that shakes out in elections.
So, Ben, as we sit here today, July 2nd, recording early because of the holiday, your Cleveland Guardians have the best record in the American League. You proudly wear that Cleveland C cap around the Gongwer offices. You've known a lot of heartbreak as a Cleveland sports fan, but how does this all finish for them?
This is amazing. It's an amazing day. Not only is that had that happened, but Donovan Mitchell has re-signed with the Cavs to a very large extension. He got his money. It's a good day to be a Cleveland sports fan. You know, the Guardians and you know their former team that I shall not name had just perpetually been in this cycle of you get a little bit better, you have a breakthrough like they did in 2016, and then it just falls off the map and just, you know, years of destitution follow. And that seems to be the name of the game living near Lake Erie. But man, this team is hot. Stephen Kwan is just a monster. He can't miss. Great batting average there. Jose Ramirez, can I say more? You know,
you see what we hear in the office, Shayna. This is what we have to put up with. And, you know, we know Shayna and I know destitution being fans of the Detroit Tigers and most Detroit sports
Surprise
teams.
Surprised you we will hire this guy.
I know, right? We will look on with envy at you.
I'm happy to be here, guys. Happy to be here. Hey, the Detroit Tigers, they'll get back, man. If we can get back, you can get back. That's for sure.
One day. The great hope continues. All right, Ben Solis from Gongwer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guest, Ben Solis from Gongwer. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gongwer's Zach Borchow and Alethea Kasbin.
Additional production and editing by Hearns Laguerre Jr., mixing, mastering, and music by Sam Bobian.
Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Learn more about Gongwer News Service at gongwer.com.
Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this podcast, you can support WDET by going to wdet.org/give. We'll talk to you next week.